Every person is made in the Imago Dei, the image of God, and we have an inherent dignity because of that.
The dignity of humanity. Anticipation mounts about the expected release of Pope Leo XIV's first encyclical, believed to provide Catholic guidance on the challenging new world of artificial intelligence. Just as we mark the anniversary of a groundbreaking encyclical of another Pope Leo, written to address the upheaval of the Industrial Revolution more than 100 years ago. The two Leos and the critical times they both addressed, we discuss with our panel of experts. All eyes are on the all-important China-U.S. summit. Yes, a focus on trade, technology, and the Iran war, but also, can progress be made to free those suffering from religious persecution in Chinese prisons?
So, I was surprised when he said, the Holy Father has appointed you the next Bishop of Belleville.
And Pope Leo starts to shape the next generation of Catholic bishops. We go to America's heartland to talk with one of his newest bishops, a Benedictine monk who now leads a diocese. EWTN News in Depth starts now.
Welcome to EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadro. Catholics all over the world are eagerly awaiting news of Pope Leo XIV's first encyclical. Many anticipate the Holy Father will use the document, reportedly called Magnifica Humanitas, or Magnificent Humanity, to speak of the Church's rich tradition of social doctrine, to affirm human dignity, and to provide moral guidance for a world rapidly changed by artificial intelligence. More than a century ago this week, his predecessor, Leo XIII, also sought to address the pressing moral questions of a changing world in the wake of industrialization. His response, the groundbreaking encyclical Rerum Novarum, became the North Star for Catholic social teaching.
Pope Leo XIII is often considered the first modern pope. He led the Church from 1878 to 1903, a time when the world was being transformed by the Industrial Revolution. Technological advances spurred manufacturing, urbanized cities, and exacerbated wage inequality. Rose Luminello, assistant teaching professor at the Keough School of Global Affairs at the University of Notre Dame, explains the working class faced meager conditions.
Workers were working 15, 16 hours a day, very dangerous jobs, dangerous in their environment, dangerous because of the machinery, dangerous because of the long hours.
It was this spirit of revolutionary change and class disparity that Pope Leo responded to in his 1891 encyclical, Rerum Novarum, or On the Condition of Labor. In this pivotal document, Leo emphasizes the human dignity of laborers and their right to just wages, safe working conditions, rest, and association. Employers have a responsibility to look after these rights and to help their workers thrive. He writes, "The hiring of labor and the conduct of trade are concentrated in the hands of comparatively few, so that a small number of very rich men have been able to lay upon them the teeming masses of the laboring poor, a yoke little better than that of slavery itself. The solution to poverty cannot be found in socialism," writing that if private property were transferred to community ownership, the working man himself would be among the first to suffer. "The solution can only be found in the light of the Church, for it is the Church that insists on the authority of the gospel upon those teachings whereby the conflict can be brought to an end or rendered at least far less bitter." Rerum Novarum is Leo XIII's most well-known writing and the first comprehensive encyclical to address social justice. That led it to become the framework for modern Catholic social teaching, the moral theology that explains how the Church addresses contemporary issues within society. And it is groundbreaking in another way.
It's the first document that really engages with the laity directly from the Pope to the people without the pulpit in the middle, without translation in the middle. for the first time in the history of the church.
The pivotal document also inspired our new pope, who told the College of Cardinals that he chose the name Leo because of Rerum Novarum and how it addressed the Industrial Revolution.
In our own day, the Church offers to everyone the treasury of her social teaching in response to another industrial revolution and to developments in the field of artificial intelligence that pose new challenges for the defense of human dignity, justice, and labor.
But for scholars like Luminello, who study Leo XIII, the connection required no explanation.
So I heard Leo XIV and I automatically knew AI revolution, industrial revolution, democracy, politics, religion. This is a very clear and timely intervention.
Joining me now are two voices to help us unpack the enduring legacy of Rerum Novarum, why it still matters 135 years later, and its influence on Pope Leo XIV's pontificate today. Dr. Michael Pakalik is a political economy professor at the Catholic University of America and a professor with the Pontifical Academy of St. Thomas Aquinas. A philosopher and author, Dr. Pakalik is a leading Catholic thinker on economics, virtue, and the Church's social teaching tradition, all of which are important tenets in Rerum Novarum. And Deacon Omar Gutierrez is a permanent deacon in the Archdiocese of Omaha, Nebraska, as well as the director of the Society for the Propagation of the Faith in the Archdiocese of Omaha. Deacon Gutierrez is a highly sought-out Catholic speaker, including on this topic of Rerum Novarum. Thank you both for being here on this big anniversary. Deacon, I want to start with you. Can you summarize the main message of Rerum Novarum and its significance when it comes to shaping Catholic social teaching today? I mean, how radical was it at the time, and how important does this document remain for the life of the Church today?
It was very radical for the time. The responses to it were very emotional from some because it was the first foray into addressing this modern world in this specific way that Pope Leo kind of started and that many popes since then have continued. Almost every single pope since Pope Leo XIII have added to the social teaching with this understanding that the Church has a role in the modern world to help guide Catholics how to respond to the revolutions that are occurring in our time. So from that perspective, it was radical and it has continued to this very day, so that Pope Francis had two, Pope Benedict XVI talked about it all the time. It's still very much relevant to our day.
Mm. Michael, what in your opinion are some misconceptions surrounding Rerum Novarum today? And what is important context surrounding its 1891 release that we need to keep in mind as we read through it now?
Well, I think just about everything that people think about it is mistaken. So that's the first thing I would do. I'd say go and read the document because it's really rich and it's profound. And, you know, you could see, you'll learn a lot from it. So, you know, for example, people say that it established unions or supported unions. Mm. But what Leo XIII envisioned was voluntary associations of Catholic workers to support them in their faith. And so he had no patience for secular workers' unions. That's one misconception. Or the living wage. Living wage was the idea that employers were tending to pay men just enough to keep themselves alive as individuals. So they weren't receiving a wage that would be adequate to support their wife and children. Mm. So the idea of a living wage is that women and children wouldn't have to work outside the house because the head of the household would be paid enough to support an entire household. Mm. Now, this needs to be recreated somehow in tax law because employees cannot, according to current law, pay somebody more if he has dependents than somebody who has no dependents. And it's not at all the same as a minimum wage.
That's fascinating. Deacon, I see you nodding your head along. So if you have anything more to add, please do. But I do want to ask you as well, Deacon. Rerum Novarum states no practical solution of this question will be found apart from the intervention of religion and of the Church when it comes to, again, this topic of labor conditions. So Deacon, can you speak to that? What is the role of the Church in intervening and engaging on these very types of issues?
It's first of all noting, as the good doctor said, that this is not just a question of the material well-being, the physical well-being of peoples, but of their spiritual well-being. The responsibility Pope Leo XIII in Rerum Novarum talks about responsibilities of employers. One of those responsibilities is for the spiritual well-being of his employees, that they have the time to worship and that they have the freedom to do so. This sense of this integration between the material and the spiritual, which is so much a part of Pope Leo's document, it's what's then is brought up a time and time again with the various popes as we talk about the progress of people's integrated human development, etc.
Wow. So every employer, secular included, has this, like you were saying, this spiritual responsibility.
Exactly right.
But I think it's important to understand that by the church, Pope Leo doesn't mean the clerics or the hierarchy. He means the full body of the church. And he, an entire quarter of the encyclical is addressed to civil society and what people can do in civil society. And he's very wary of the state. Leo XIII was extremely wary of state power. And he thought it would be a huge mistake for the state to step in here and set and kind of claim additional power to solve these problems.
Mm. And Michael, I want to talk about applying it to today. So what does Rerum Novarum still have to teach young Catholics, for example, who are navigating the modern economic pressures and today's cultural instability? How can we apply the teachings of Rerum Novarum to modern day life?
Well, I think, first of all, it's part of becoming educated as a Catholic citizen and Catholic participant in what is, frankly, a commercial society, which we have in the United States. So, and above all, it's not a matter of kind of memorizing certain lines or rules. It's a matter of incorporating it. So I do think that what we teach in our school is that students should be reading this almost prayerfully. I think the deacon would agree, and kind of engage in a kind of examination of conscience and thinking carefully. No, I think the immediate upshot is we're certainly training a lot of people who are going to go into management or start companies. Mm-hmm. So there's a great degree of sensitivity to the worker in Rerum Novarum. Especially, you could sum it up in the golden rule, just do unto others as you would have done unto you. And so this is a very important part of educating young persons in a business school environment, which is what I'm in.
Mm. And would you both say, I mean, is this ultimate message? It's about upholding the dignity of the laborer, but ultimately work has to serve the family. Is that a correct takeaway?
Yeah, that's the central cell of society is the family. That's one of the great points that's being made. It's not the individual so much as the family, because when the next Pope, Pius XI, who adds to the social teaching, he talks about this term social justice, which is used so much and which is coined by him in that document. It's the first time the church uses that phrase. The idea is there precisely that we're supporting the family, that we all have a joint responsibility to do that. And the only other thing I'll add to that is the sense of discernment, right? That this is a spiritual project. Living the social teaching is a spiritual project as well as an economic and a political one, so that we're noticing as in our communion with the Holy Spirit and the Trinity, whether we're an employer or an employee, because the responsibility is for employees too, we're noticing where the Holy Spirit is guiding us to love better in the context of our workplace.
Mm, I love that reminder of discernment, especially applying it to today, because the workplace looks so different than it did in 1891. I like both of your thoughts on this, and just to reflect on what are some revolutionary changes of today that you expect and maybe hope that Pope Leo XIV will tackle in his highly anticipated first encyclical. Michael, I'll start with you.
Well, I do think that the thing he should be tackling is what I would call sterile sex. And that's the main problem in our society. And I'm afraid that AI looks like it's not really that important in comparison with this issue related to demographic decline and the fall of the family and divorce and so on. Mm. But I think that there is a strong analogy of certain thing, but it's not AI. The Rerum Novarum was concerned about the family being broken up and reached into by the employer. And so that no longer were families gathering together in their house, but they had to be on the shop floor at all times. Mm. And they didn't have time, as Deacon said, no time for worship, no time for leisure, no time for education. And everybody in the household was actually directly dependent upon an employer in one of these workhouses. And the analog to this today, and I wrote a Catholic Think piece on this, is actually what's called surveillance capitalism, where through devices, big companies are gaining the attention of children and everyone in a household. So you walk into a modern household, everybody's in on a different device in a different part of the house, and they're actually directly in contact with influencers and with people trying to sell them things and people trying to keep them addicted. And this is the analog to the employer pulling the family out of the household and onto the shop floor.
Wow, that separation and isolation. Deacon, last word goes to you. What are you hoping to see Pope Leo XIV tackle?
Yeah, the only thing I would add to what the good doctor said, which I agree with entirely, is maybe more specifically the role of social media and all that. Pope Francis addressed this as a little bit in Fratelli Tutti, but I'd like, since there's more information now we have through social science, the effect this is having on adolescents and so therefore the family, mm-hmm. And then, you know, the way AI is into helping add to that problem.
Professor, Deacon, thank you both so much. Grateful to have you both. Thank you.
Glad to be here.
And this note, this week marked not only the important papal anniversary of Pope Leo XIII's Rerum Novarum, it also marked the 45th anniversary of another major papal event, the attempted assassination of St. John Paul II in St. Peter's Square in 1981. On Wednesday, Pope Leo XIV prayed in silence at the marble plaque designating where the Polish Pope was shot four times, his wounds so serious he was hospitalized for 5 months. For the rest of his life, St. John Paul II never ceased to express his gratitude to the Virgin Mary, Our Lady of Fatima, for saving his life. Next on this edition of EWTN News in Depth, consequential events on the world stage.
Jimmy Lai, he caused lots of turmoil for China. He tried to do the right thing. He wasn't successful. He went to jail, and people would like him out, and I'd like to see him get out, too.
President Trump speaks about high-profile prisoners in China on the eve of his summit in China. A panel with close personal ties to those imprisoned joins us next.
I've been a monk now for 38 years, and I must admit, as an extrovert, it seemed at times that this was really not a natural fit.
The initial challenge of becoming a monk now morphs into the challenge of becoming a bishop. A talk with one of Pope Leo's brand new bishops, selected to lead the American church into the future.
Music is impactful. Music has meaning. Music can be beautiful, so it can uplift the dignity of the listener.
And later, we'll have the story of one man's mission to bring music and hope to inmates in prison. The impact of his Catholic music ministry ahead.
In a ceremonial greeting on Wednesday, President Donald Trump meets his Chinese counterpart, President Xi Jinping, beginning a rare trip to Beijing. Despite the fanfare, Trump faces growing pressure back home to reckon with the Chinese Communist Party's intensified crackdown on religion and those with dissenting views. For months, family members, advocates, and lawmakers on both sides of the aisle have urged Trump to use his trip to China, his first in 9 years, to push for the release of several high-profile prisoners. One of the most prominent is the pro-democracy activist and devout Catholic Jimmy Lai. But in new comments on Friday, Trump signaled his release is looking unlikely.
What about Jimmy Lai?
It's a tougher one. That's I did bring it up. It's a tougher one for him. It's a tougher one.
What did he say about
it? For him, it's a very. He told me. I don't want to mislead anybody. He said Jimmy Lai is a tough one for him to do. He went through a lot, and right or wrong, he went through a lot. So he told me that would be a tough one. He said he's going to strongly consider the pastor.
The media tycoon founded the now-defunct pro-democracy newspaper Apple Daily and often criticized the Chinese Communist Party. He was arrested in 2020 under China's sweeping national security law. After a drawn-out sham trial, Lai was sentenced to 20 years in prison in February under charges of sedition and colluding with foreign forces. His family now worries the 78-year-old, who has suffered failing health behind bars, could die in prison. His daughter, Claire, reacted to Trump's comments to EWTN News on Friday.
We are just so extremely grateful. You know, Of course, the dream was for my father to come back on Air Force One, but I remain extremely confident that it's him and his administration that will secure the release of my father. In the days that follow, I hope that the Holy Spirit might move President Xi's heart, and he might see the wisdom in releasing my aging and ailing father.
Claire also emphasized her father's faith has remained strong through his suffering and has even helped him come to understand God's mercy in a deeper way.
Did you bring up with President Xi getting the political prisoners of China? Are any going to be released? Any progress?
I think he's giving very serious consideration to the past Xi.
But those comments aboard Air Force One on Friday give hope that another prisoner held in China could soon be released. Pastor Ezra Jin was detained at his home in October 2025, along with dozens of other church leaders across China. He is the founder of Zion Church, one of China's largest underground house church networks. Joining me now in our EWTN News studio are two guests who understand China's religious persecution all too well. Grace Jin Drexel is the daughter of Pastor Ezra Jin. She previously served as a research analyst in the Senate and the Congressional Executive Commission on China. She currently works as the director of advocacy at the Luke Alliance. Sam Brownback is the former U.S. Ambassador at Large for International Religious Freedom from 2018 to 2021. He also previously served as a U.S. Senator for Kansas and was the 46th governor of Kansas and is the author of a new book released just this week called China's War on Faith. Thank you both for being here. Grace, I want to begin with you because we heard the president's comments on Friday. Is there any update about your father? Anything you can tell us that you've heard from the White House or lawyers? Are we closer to getting your father released?
Well, thank you so much. I've also saw the video recording of the president at Air Force One mentioning my father, and I was just so grateful and thankful. But this is the most hope that we've felt as a family since my father has been detained in October, and along with the 17 other church leaders, this is again just such a miracle that we've been praying for all this time. We know that the road ahead is still long, but again, we're just so thankful and had so much hope that we haven't had.
So much hope and momentum right now. Ambassador, I understand you are banned from entering China.
Yes, one of my great accolades in my life is to be banned by the People's Republic of China.
And tell us, what is China's relationship with religion? Explain to us the everyday reality facing Christians and Catholics there.
Well, the everyday reality is this is suppressed, oppressed, and in some cases, they just try to annihilate it altogether. And it's a thoroughness. It's Christians, it's Buddhists, it's Muslims, it's Falun Gong. It's a Chinese communist regime that cannot tolerate any group that has an authority that's higher than the government. Mm. And if you do, they are going to oppress you or they're going to control you some way or another, and they have to do this. And then they've developed these very effective systems to do this as well, with facial recognition and tracking devices on cell phones and all these things that they then freely share with other dictators to make them better dictators. It's really the way it's going to be in countries that are dictatorially run unless we break through this.
That monitoring and tracking is used to monitor if people are going to underground churches?
Underground churches. It's really to find the needle in the haystack. Mm. It's to find the pastor Ezra Jin. Mm-hmm. Now, he was easily found because it was an above-ground church, but most of the church leaders are not, and they're meeting in small groups. And it's to find that one person that's leading the other people, grab them, get them out, and deal with them.
And Grace, give us more background on your father. Tell us about the reach of his ministry and how his arrest came about in October.
Yes, so my father became a pastor and became a Christian and then a pastor after the 1989 Tiananmen student protest, where he had just such a loss of faith in everything that he believed in prior to that. And at the depth of his despair, he he found Christ, just like many people in the world, and found hope and joy and became a pastor soon afterwards. And from then, in 2007, he began Zion Church as an independent church away from the government, because just like Ambassador said, he realized that inside the government structure, they were controlling everything, including what can be taught in Bible studies, how many people can be baptized, etc. And so that felt like a church in captivity and not a church glorifying to the Lord. So the church, my father's church, starting from 2007, grew to around 1,500 people up to 2018 until it was crushed by the government, and we did not have any location to meet in Beijing. But my father, again, just being faithful, started his ministry online and offline, and that, beyond anyone's imagination, during COVID, it blew up and became a nationwide church, and we were ministering for tens and thousands of people. And one scholar said, instead of 7 years of despair, we had 7 years of harvest, and that we were able to minister to more people than we have ever imagined. And because of that, I think the Chinese Communist Party came after my father and the leaders.
Ambassador, you served in the first Trump administration. Are you hopeful President Trump can get Pastor Jin and Jimmy Lai released from prison in China? And can you give us some insight as to what those conversations with China must be looking like right now?
Well, I worked with him on Andrew Brunson that he got out in that first administration. And when the president gets focused on these things, he really goes after it. And he'll use the trying to really encourage Xi to do this and everything. And if that doesn't work, he'll use a club. So I think really there is good hope on this, and I hope on both cases. And I hope as well for the nine Catholic bishops that are that are in detention now in China. Nine Catholic bishops. I really hope the president, I hope Pope Leo will start pushing publicly to get these bishops out.
Grace, what can you tell us and what do you know about the status of your father's health, and when's the last time you heard from him?
Yeah, honestly, we don't know too much, and the only communication that we have is through lawyers. We haven't seen him, we haven't heard from him. There hasn't been any phone calls at all, and we only get to hear from lawyers. But and recently they've also been attacking our lawyers, so we've been also in between lawyers, so we've gotten even less information. Based on the little that we know, it's not looking good. He has severe type 2 diabetes, and he hasn't had the medication that the doctor prescribed him. The food is like horrible, and his sleeping conditions, it's basically just a mat on the floor, and there's not even windows on his cell. And so the wind and the rain can just come in whenever. And it's just, we just hope and pray that the Lord is sustaining him in the cell. Mm. But we're also really concerned about his health.
Of course. And we just, again, we join you and your family in prayer. Ambassador, you mentioned those nine Catholic bishops who are imprisoned in China. Can you speak more about what is that specific action you would like to see from the Vatican and from Pope Leo?
Publicly asking for their release, pushing for it. The Vatican typically does this on a private basis and quiet basis, and I understand their desire to do that, but that hasn't been working. And these are nine leaders of the Catholic Church, and now the Catholic Church in China, the Communist Party is directly appointing bishops. And you're going, no, that this is a church that the church gets to appoint its bishops. And the Chinese Communist Party is claiming they get to appoint the next Dalai Lama. And you're, no, you don't get to do that. The Tibetan Buddhists do this. Mm. And I think I would really hope the Vatican would start publicly coming out and saying this is wrong treatment of a religious body, of religious leaders. And we're going to start speaking out against the Chinese Communist Party for what they're doing. On top of the three religious genocides that are going on right now in China. Yeah, of the Uyghurs, of the Falun Gong, of the Tibetan Buddhist.
Thank you for raising awareness about that. And you write about that in your new book as well. Grace, I understand that even before his imprisonment, your father was banned from leaving China. And now here you are, you're pregnant, I believe, with your third child.
Yes.
Do you mind just sharing what your family has missed out on these past few years with your father not here.
Thank you. In 2018, when my father, right before my father's church was dismantled in the physical location, my family, my mom and my brothers and I came to the U.S. And my father decided to, he was with us initially, and he went back to China to be with the church after realizing the fact that he wasn't in China, wasn't de-escalating in any way, and he wanted to be with the church and suffer with the church. And since then, he wasn't allowed to leave China, so it's been many, like 8 years for our family members, and he hasn't seen my brothers graduate. Before they were in elementary school and middle school, and now they're in college and going to college next year. My dad was not there to walk me down the aisle at my wedding, and my two kids, they have never met their grandfather. And now with my baby boy, we still don't think, I mean, I just hope and pray that we will be able to meet my dad, and that he will be both a spiritual and just a familial mentor to everyone.
We're going to share in that hope for you and your family as well. Grace. And Ambassador, just in my final moment with you both, you know, the role Ambassador at Large for International Religious Freedom, I believe, remains vacant right now in the Trump administration. Can you just share your reaction to that, and what risks does that vacancy pose?
Well, they had a nominee, wasn't able to get on through the Senate, and I think they're vetting some additional people now to get it appointed. What happens is you lose that voice then inside the administration and exterior across the world. Because I traveled a lot, and you could go with the authority of the president, authority of the United States government, and say, and talk about religious freedom cases or people that should be released. But also inside the administration, you can advocate for these policies that will push religious freedom, which we really need. We're the country in the world that stands for this, and you need to be strong. And President Trump has been on this, and we really pray and hope that he continues to show that strength.
Well, I thank you for your work and advocacy on this issue. And Grace, thank you for your witness. Again, we all join our prayers with you and your family.
Thank you so much.
Absolutely. We have more on President Trump's visit to China. News headlines are next in the Week in Review. We turn once again to President Donald Trump's high-stakes trip to China in the Week in Review. The president noted, quote, a lot of different problems were settled over the 2 days of meetings with his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping, but he left Beijing on Friday without any major signed agreements to show for it. The fanfare and cordial atmosphere of the trip showed a newly stable relationship between China and the U.S., though it resulted in no breakthroughs on the war in Iran and minimal economic wins. U.S. tariffs on China, expected to be a major point of conversation, were not even addressed, according to Trump. Xi delivered a blunt warning to Trump on Taiwan, a self-ruled island that Beijing claims as its own territory, saying that if the U.S. handled the situation poorly, the two countries could enter, quote, an extremely dangerous place. Trump told reporters after his three-day trip that he will weigh advancing an arms sale to Taiwan worth billions of dollars, saying the last thing the U.S. needs is a war that's thousands of miles away. But that is what the U.S. has in Iran. Despite a ceasefire, negotiations between the U.S. and Iran to end the conflict are not going smoothly. Earlier this week, Trump dismissed Iran's latest formal proposal as, quote, garbage. The Iranian foreign minister responded this week saying there is no trust and negotiations are not advancing because the U.S. is making what he calls contradictory statements with excessive irrational rhetoric. President Trump made reference to his conversation with President Xi about Iran on the last day of the China-U.S. summit.
We did discuss Iran. We feel very similar in Iran. We want that to end. We don't want them to have a nuclear weapon. We want the straits open. We're closing it now. They closed it, then we closed it on top of them. But we want the straits open.
China did not offer any direct help, however, in solving the impasse with Iran over the Strait of Hormuz. In the meantime, even as the summit was underway, Iranian media reported more than 30 ships, some linked to Chinese companies, were allowed to transit the Strait of Hormuz overnight because of their cooperation with Iranian naval forces. The war in Iran, the closing of the Strait of Hormuz, and rising fuel and transportation costs
are having a dramatic effect on American wallets. This week, the Bureau of Labor Statistics reported the Consumer Price Index has hit an annual rate of 3.8%, the highest inflation rate in nearly 3 years. In individual consumer categories, gas was up 5.4% last month, airfare up 2.8%, and with rising diesel fuel prices for truckers, fresh fruits and vegetables were up 2.3%, the highest monthly increase in that category in 16 years.
We have taken such a major step back in the fight against inflation. There's nowhere to hide here from inflation. Price increases are happening. They're happening quickly.
As of this week, the price of oil has risen more than 70% since the start of the year. Analysts warn increased energy costs and their widespread impact have not yet fully worked their way through the economy, meaning the rising price of consumer goods is only going to get worse in the months ahead. The Trump administration this week announced a new proposal that would expand benefits for fertility treatments. The rule would create a supplemental insurance option employers could offer workers, like vision or dental insurance, for diagnosing, mitigating, or treating infertility. President Trump announced the proposal during a maternal health event at the White House.
This will hopefully reduce the number of couples who ultimately need to resort to IVF. Because challenges can be identified and addressed very early in the process. This is a new benefit. This is a benefit that so many people have called me about.
The proposed rule would cover lab tests, medications, and genetic testing, but would also include in vitro fertilization, or IVF, a practice the Catholic Church teaches is morally unacceptable because life is created outside of the marital act, and many embryonic human persons are either frozen, used for experimentation, or discarded. The White House also announced its launch of a new website for maternal health. It provides information, resources, and a database of pro-life pregnancy centers across the country. The Supreme Court this week allowed the abortion pill mifepristone to be delivered through the mail while a legal battle plays out in the lower courts. The order follows a temporary stay on a federal appeals court's ruling issued earlier this month, requiring the drug to be prescribed through an in-person doctor visit nationwide. The high court's decision means that ruling could be blocked for months and could eventually make its way back onto the docket. Pro-life advocates express their disappointment in the order, as several studies have found the pill poses dangerous risks for the mother, let alone the unborn child. And a continuing controversy within the Catholic Church bubbled to the surface this week. The Vatican's doctrine chief issued a final warning to the Society of St. Pius X, or the SSPX, that if it moves forward with consecrating new bishops without a papal mandate, it will be a schismatic act resulting in excommunication. Cardinal Victor Manuel Fernandez, prefect of the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith, stated, "This act will constitute a schismatic act, and formal adherence to schism constitutes a grave offense against God and entails the excommunication established by the law of the Church." Cardinal Fernandez also said Pope Leo XIV continues to pray that the SSPX will reconsider the very grave decision they've made. The SSPX, which exclusively celebrates the traditional Latin Mass, maintains doctrinal differences with certain teachings and reforms of the Second Vatican Council, particularly in regard to religious freedom and the Church's approach to other faiths. The SSPX has declared it intends to proceed with illicit episcopal consecrations at its international seminary in Aachen, Switzerland, on July 1st, in defiance of the Vatican's warnings of schism. EWTN News will continue to monitor this much-watched controversy closely and will report developments as they occur this summer.
No, I'm not interested. And my exact words were, you all get up too early in the morning and you don't talk enough for me.
Next, he's one of America's newest bishops now. But back then, he wasn't so sure that becoming a monk was the right fit for him. When we come back, we introduce you to the Benedictine monk Pope Leo has tapped to lead a diocese in the rural Midwest.
EWTN News in Depth continues our series of interviews with new Catholic bishops as Pope Leo XIV begins his impact on the ranks of the episcopacy around the world. In the United States, since becoming pope, he has made roughly 30 bishop changes so far by naming new bishops, moving existing bishops to new positions, and accepting the retirements of others. An analysis of Pope Leo's bishop appointments to date shows a reflection of his own background, prioritizing pastoral care, administrative skills, and leaders that mirror the diversity of the faithful in the pews. A notable number of the new bishops were born in other countries and have become naturalized citizens of the U.S., a recognition, perhaps, of the global human family. Many bring experiences shaped by Latin America, university ministry, military service, and diocesan governance. One of Pope Leo's newest U.S. bishops comes from a large rural diocese in Middle America. Bishop Godfrey Molin is the rare Benedictine monk who has been elevated to lead a diocese. And he was named to the Diocese of Belleville, Illinois, a special honor as it's his hometown where he grew up. Bishop Molin spoke to our EWTN News colleague, reporter Jonah McCune of the National Catholic Register, about the call he got from then-Papal Nuncio to the United States, Cardinal Christophe Pierre.
When you found out that Pope Leo XIV had appointed you as bishop of your home diocese, what was your first reaction?
My first reaction during the phone call was a bit of surprise, to be honest, for two reasons. It's uncommon for someone to be named bishop of his home diocese, but it's also uncommon for someone who has been elected administrator of a diocese to become the bishop. And so for both of those reasons, I presumed that it wouldn't happen. I was surprised when he said, the Holy Father has appointed you the next Bishop of Belleville. And he did not ask if I would accept that appointment until later. But Cardinal Pierre, he just asked, he told me, you've been appointed. And so, it was a bit surprising and yet at the same time consoling in a very real way. As I said in my press conference, these are people that I've known since I was 9 months old. These are people whose relationship with Christ has fascinated me since I was a little boy, particularly through our youth program in the diocese. Seeing these massive youth groups from small farm communities, that always intrigued me. And so my relationship with the diocese is longstanding. And so on the one hand, it was surprising. And on the other hand, it was exciting because I know this diocese and I love this diocese. And I don't have a lot of a learning curve in terms of meeting the people and knowing who they are.
What would you say you kind of bring to this new role as bishop from your formation and life as a monk that you think will kind of complement this new role?
I think this can be hard for some people. Monastic life, and especially the rule, they give us some clear boundaries in which we live our lives. And some people don't like boundaries at all. And to be honest, in the 14 years that I've been in parish ministry, the conflicts that I've been a part of, generally speaking, that's what they're about. People don't want to be held accountable to the norms of the church, or people don't want to hear what the gospel says. And the monastic life, I think, provides that. St. Benedict wrote the rule after living in a cave for 2 years. And he was living in that cave because the culture of Rome at the end of the 5th century was horrific, so corrupt. And he wanted to envision a life where people lived better in peace. And that's where the rule comes from. And I don't want to criticize the world in which we live, but there is clearly corruption. And there are clearly elements of our life in our day that need healing and fixing. And I think that ability to envision something that leads to peace, I think 38 years of living in that environment will be a big help in terms of how do we move forward as a diocese.
As part of you being a Benedictine, it's true that, you know, even as a bishop, you are certainly still subject to the rule, and even more so subject to the mm-hmm. rule. How do you envision that fact kind of living out in your life as a bishop?
When Cardinal Pierre called, I asked him, do I need the permission of my abbot to accept this appointment? And he chuckled, and then he said, oh no, Father, your obedience is now to the Holy Father. And to be perfectly honest, that created a lot of anxiety in me because of 38 years of experience. But then he went on to say, but remain a monk, be a man of community, be a man of prayer, and be a man of simplicity. And then he said, I'm lecturing you, and you know better than I. Ha 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 ha. But in a real way, I think he summed up what my responsibility as a monk who becomes a bishop is. I am to remain a man of prayer, which through God's grace I have remained the entire time I've lived outside the monastery, and the whole life of simplicity and community, those I breathe in and out every day. And so I think that will not only help me remain who I am and continue to give me consolation in the life that I'm now living, but also I think it's a gift that I bring to the church in Southern Illinois.
Your appointment kind of comes at a time when the world is still getting to know our Holy Father, mm-hmm. and trying to figure out his priorities. What do you think your appointment says about our Holy Father?
He is certainly not afraid to appoint a religious as bishop, and he is also not afraid at all to appoint an administrator of a diocese as the ordinary, because I am not the first one that he has appointed. And so that tells me that certain concerns that might have been on the minds of previous popes, he's not as worried about those things as they are. I also think that his constant call to peace, while I would never want to claim him as a Benedictine because I know he is proud of his Augustinian heritage, that is such a Benedictine mindset, and it's a Christian mindset, all told. And so I think that element is especially important to me, that we have to work for peace. And we live in a world where too often there is just all kinds of willingness to be at war with each other, at odds with each other, even in our families. And a priority of peace for me is certainly very important. And so I'm excited about what he has to bring to the church. I think his own missionary experience makes him far more fearless than a lot of people. And I'm encouraged by that as well.
You very much described yourself as a son of this diocese, of the Belleville Diocese. You've lived here since you were 9 months old, right? What does this little slice of the world mean to you?
There is a warmth in the Diocese of Belleville that I find incredibly attractive. And as I said to somebody recently, I was bored out of my mind in high school. And I even wrote to the governor of the state of Illinois to say that he should figure something out for high school kids in Southern Illinois. I never heard back, understandably so. As an adult, I look back on that and think to myself, that calm, peaceful life, there was something that was formative about that I don't think a parent could have paid for in any way. And as an adult, I am far more grateful for that than I ever was as a teenager. And I think that's really what small town America, in a lot of places, that's what it offers. It offers a place where, yes, everybody knows everybody and everyone's business, but where also people can rely on each other and love getting to know each other. And it's where I think our small parishes, and our large ones too, but our small parishes in particular, there is a sense of community there that is remarkable.
May God bless Bishop Mullen and his continued stewardship of the Diocese of Belleville, Illinois. Be sure to go to the National Catholic Register for Jonah's article about this interview, and for an extended video version of our interview with many more topics covered, visit the EWTN News YouTube page to watch the entire discussion, including more about Bishop Mullen's formation as a priest, what he thinks are some of the biggest issues facing the church today, and his hopes for bringing his flock closer to Christ.
There's a difference in prison between getting home and getting free, and this music helps you to get free.
And next, a prison inmate shares with us the impact of a program called Concerts of Hope. We talk to the musician bringing inspiration behind jail bars.
What would our spiritual life be without the inspiration and joy we feel at the sound of music at church? But what we might expect and perhaps take for granted as we attend Mass is a luxury inside of prison walls. One Catholic musician has made it his mission to bring the joy of music to those who are incarcerated. Reporter Roselle Regis introduces us to musician Eric Genuis and tells us about his transformation from a reluctant prison minister to one who now plays for all who ask. Here is his faith journey in depth.
A master pianist and composer, Eric Genuis has been performing all over the world for decades. From Hollywood to Slovakia, he has wowed and inspired audiences with his music and his stories.
I love writing music. It's like a boy playing with Lego. You know, I'm like a little kid playing when I'm writing music. And it's so much fun, right? So it inspires me.
After leaving Canada and moving to the United States with his wife, Leslie, Genuis decided to start a new venture. In 2016, he started a charitable effort called Concerts for Hope. It started with a simple invitation.
And I promised myself and I promised our Lord when I was a young man that I would never say no to a concert. One day when I was on tour, a man said, "Hey, listen, I work in a prison as a chaplain. Would you ever come in and play?"
Genuis was hesitant, but kept his promise. He booked world-class musicians and prepared for his first ever concert in prison. He'll never forget his initial reaction to the environment.
I remember marveling at how unattractive everything was. The grounds were unkept. The lawn furniture was all broken. I walked into the prison and, you know, the inmates walk up one side, walk down another. They kind of saunter. They interact with each other is, you know, it's often less than respectable in the way that they would interact with the COs, the correctional officers or the guards is often low. And I remember thinking this is just overall not an uplifting or inspiring. There's nothing beautiful.
Genuis performed, and the reaction from inmates inspired him.
We started playing, and I'll never forget, this man in the second row throws up his arms, and he yells out. Now, he's in there for a double murder. He's not going anywhere. He got 60 years. He's going nowhere. And he yells out, "I forgot what hope felt like." And I was so moved that he was so moved.
Genuis felt ashamed. Ashamed because he was initially reluctant to perform in prison. As a devout Catholic, he knows that visiting those in prison is a corporal act of mercy, but has never pursued it until that moment.
Why do I go in prisons? Because God will never stop pursuing anybody. Who am I to then stop pursuing them, right? So if our Lord found meaning and he said, "Go and play for those who are sick, those who are imprisoned," I'm going. That's a command from my commander-in-chief, if you will.
25 years later, he has made Concerts for Hope his life's work.
A lot of times we feel like we're suffering in isolation. You know, we cut off from the outside world. So you can easily fall into a space where you believe some of the stereotypes about you. And so when you have people coming in, it kind of like humanizes us again.
We joined Genuis for a concert at State Correctional Institution Cole Township, a medium security all-male prison in Pennsylvania, where Nyako has spent his entire adult life so far behind bars.
We believe that justice and mercy can live in the same house alongside redemption and accountability. We believe Eric brings that in with his music and just gives these gentlemen an opportunity to look forward to positive things in their life.
Concerts for Hope is not just the concert. Eric Genuis speaks to inmates about compassion, redemption, and human dignity.
He talks about the dignity of the human person and that our worst moments do not have to define us, that we can partake of the graces that come to us in our everyday moments.
Another inmate, Harlow, who tells us he has since reconnected with the Catholic faith since he has been incarcerated, appreciated the concert.
It reminds us that we can carry ourselves with dignity. We forget that we are human beings and we should smile at one another. For every good influence, there's probably 10 bad influences. And finding a community, a Catholic community, has saved me you know, it's kept me grounded.
For Shelby, who is serving a life sentence, a concert like this brings him hope.
Just because you're incarcerated doesn't mean you can't be a better father and a better son and a better neighbor and just a better human.
Shelby shares the same passion for music and plays in the band for Mass.
So I like to say that music is the most powerful thing under heaven. Yeah, I think it can invoke and move any emotion.
Eric shares his struggles in life with inmates, which creates an instant bond.
Thank you. My name is Kareem. Kareem, nice to meet you.
There are many hurting people. There are many lonely people. There are many people in this world and culture that are easy to love and many that are tough to love. That's my audience. I've been doing this for 25 years. Thanks be to God, it's been going so well, and I look forward to the next 25 years.
Rasal Regis, EWTN News in Depth.
The sound of hope. And that's it for this edition of EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadro. Join us again same time next week for more news and reports important to your Catholic life. Until we see you again, God bless.